Before we get into the content for today's lecture, I just want to give you a few tips about the final. I think most of you probably have already, in your discussion sections, seen a sample final, and you got some indication from that. But let me just go over the format of the test and how it'll be structured, and then give you a little bit of a hint about what the content of those questions will be. So there are three parts to this exam. It, however, is not the same format as the previous exams. There will be no slide identification. That is to keep you from having to go back over all the visual material all semester, which actually is a little bit of a daunting task. So we're not gonna have slide ID. Even just the lists of architects and of building names gets kind of preposterous. So we're not going to have that. But we will have the first section of the exam will deal with that kind of factual material that we were doing in slide ID. But it is more about what were the examples we looked at and what were they meant to talk about. So there will be 15 questions. They're worth 2 points each, total of 30 points. About half of those questions are about what architects go with what buildings. And primarily, it's always going to be an architect that we've looked at multiple buildings they've done. So we've looked at lots of Le Corbusier's buildings, lots of Lucan's buildings, lots of Alvar Aalto's buildings, lots of Eero Saarinen's buildings. So if we've looked at multiple buildings by an architect, I might say, which of the following buildings is by Alvar Aalto? And one of them is going to be by Aalto, and the rest of them are not, and you just have to be able to identify that. Or I might say, which of the following is not designed by Lou Kahn? And there are three of them that are designed by Kahn and one that's not. You just need to be able to identify that. Simple to study for this, actually. I would just take the handouts that you get every class period, and I would just go over those and make sure I kind of know what, you know, the ones where we've got multiples, where that architect's popped up several times, I need to know their buildings and, you know, what goes with who. Just factual information. And then the second part of those, this first section, is there are going to be some of them that say, okay, when we were looking at the, let's say, history faculty in Cambridge, what was the point we were trying to make there? So it might say, which of the following describes the point that was trying to be made by the history faculty in Cambridge? And one of those is going to say, well, we dealt with it in one lecture where we looked at its human factors and its strength in that regard. We dealt with it in another lecture, and we found out that it wasn't so strong in two other regards in terms of physical considerations or form. So just it'll basically take an instance, an example, and ask you to tell me what we were looking for. And that'll all be multiple choice. So 30 points, 15 questions, 2 points each. And the way I'd study those is I'd just look at these handouts. I'd get all my handouts together, and I'd say, do I know what the point was on that building? Do I know what the point was on that building? What were we talking about there? What were we talking about there? If you know that, you're done. And then, you know, who's the architect, and have we looked at multiple buildings? Yeah, you're done there. So easy, easy breezy, right? Okay, that's section one. Section two is longer multiple choice, and these are very comparable to the ones we've had that everyone loves so much on the other tests. They're so popular that I want to be sure you get your fill of them on the final. So there will be a section that is comparable multiple choice. And that means that they're not just a simple fact, but you need to think about it a little bit. You need to understand, you know, the concept in order to be able to answer the question. And there will be, that'll be 30 points. And, no, sorry, is there, yeah, that'll be 30 points. And that will be 10 questions worth 3 points each. And those will primarily be on the first three lectures of the semester and the last two lectures of the semester.
because we didn't cover those first three very much on exam number one, and of course last time and today, we haven't had a test on them. So they're going to concentrate on those, and those were the synoptic lectures. They dealt with the whole. So those first three lectures, the last two lectures, I would say 6 or 7 out of the 10 are going to be on those lectures. And then the others are going to be looking very generally at the whole semester. It's not going to be some esoteric little bit in one lecture in some part of the semester. At least something that, you know, it might be, for instance, we've looked at the Centre Pompidou in previous lectures, and we looked at the Centre Pompidou in that lecture last time. You know, if we've sort of repeated conversation about things, that would be a good opportunity for a question in that segment. So those will be 10 questions, 3 points each, similar to the ones on the other test, but concentrating on the first three lectures and the last two lectures. And there will not be any questions on there about the books. So I'm not telling you you've got a total pass on the books. You might want to, you know, look over them a little bit, but there are not going to be real specific questions on the books. I'm such a nice guy. Oh, my God. Just such a wuss. Okay, so then the third part is short answer questions. And there are going to be 8 of these worth 5 points each, total of 40 points. And these are ones, and there may be, you know, certainly content from the books will help you answer these questions at the end, but it's not going to be some specific data because they're short answer questions, so you're going to have options on what you talk about or you don't talk about. They're going to be overarching about things we've talked about in the semester. And they honestly are concentrated on things like I ask you in Twitter cards. What do you think? Those questions, not all of them, but some of them are going to be, what do you think? So when I ask you a Twitter card about in 10 years, what are you going to be looking for in a house? You know, I want you to have been thinking about that all semester. That's kind of the freaking point of the course, is what do you think about architecture? How is it going to be beneficial to you? What are you looking for? What are you going to demand of architecture? So there's going to be some of that content in it. There also will be some of the lecture content, like when I say, what are the 12 elements of form, or what are 8 characteristics of neighborhoods that contribute to humanism, those numbered things. There's probably going to be some of them, and I might ask you, list as many as you can of the 12 elements of form, and that might be a short answer question. And I might also tag on to that, you know, okay, so which of 3 of those seem most important to you and why? So I'm probably going to ask something factual and then something that tags on to it about how do you react to that? What's important to you? And definitely in that part of it, you need to, I might reach back to the project, your building you chose for your projects in your submissions and discussion section. So you need to make sure you're conversant about that. But it'll be a lot about how you have dealt with the material that we've covered in the class. So again, you can, on that sample test that the TAs have told you about, it's on the website, you can get a pretty good sense of how those 8 short answer questions will be phrased. So, anybody got any questions on that final exam? And yes, it's way, way late in the final exam period, and I hate that, and I will tell you the TAs really, really hate that, but we don't have anything to do with it. The university assigns us a final exam time, and we got to go with it. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, you know, on the short answer stuff, no, you can have lists, you can have bullets, you can have drawings, you can have anything, just to answer the question. You don't have to have, and really, this exam will probably not, it's a 3-hour time slot, you'll all be done in an hour and a half, I'm pretty sure. So it's not going to be a timed thing, but you definitely don't need to get too verbose with us on this. Remember, the TAs have to grade this after this late, you know, exam. We still have grading to do after that. So we don't want huge, long essays. Yeah, so the more you can keep it concise, that's really good. Any other questions? Okay, so we're going to roll back and kind of expand on what we were talking about last time. Last time, as you'll recall, we were talking about perfection and compromise. How does it work where you have this myriad of different issues we're trying to deal with, juggling 90 balls in the air at the same time? And how do you deal with that 3 o'clock in the morning feeling that Alto described of, I'm just overwhelmed. There's so many things I'm supposed to be dealing with. How do I freaking get started? How do I make decisions about this? And we talked about the approach that Paul Rudolph suggested last time, where you great architects make wonderful buildings because they choose what aspects of the design problem they want to address. And they choose one or a few, and they concentrate on that, and they do it almost perfectly. And then they have to neglect other aspects of the design problem. It's just a fact. If you're going to make powerful or potent buildings, you just have to concentrate on a few issues. That's what Rudolph said. So we looked at, well, what happens when you do that? And we looked at a lot of very famous, very distinguished buildings that took that attitude. And they neglected some aspects of the building. And we could see, well, what are the consequences of neglecting some aspects of the building? And in your Twitter card question, I asked you to, well, what do you think? Is Rudolph right? Is that the right way to do it? What's the right approach? Should you seek perfection in a few areas and neglect other aspects of the building? Or should you maybe compromise and be more balanced in an approach to it? So by far, most people were more in favor of that more balanced, more compromised position. So let me read you a few of those responses. One person says, I don't think power and potency are worth the aggravation. Sacrificing important factors for a building to look powerful is stupid. There are plenty of buildings that invoke awe in the observer while still addressing practical important matters. So yeah, you could still get a powerful building. You don't have to just do a few things. Someone else says, I hate the idea of focusing on one aspect. Why would you ignore issues that you know are there? It seems stupid to me. Architects should do their best to take on all challenges and make buildings cohesive from all ends. Somebody else says, how much water a barrel can hold depends on the shortest wood plank. An optimized and enduring building must be balanced in all three areas. Someone else says, after seeing the example of Kahn's Hospital, I think a building's function and use should always be more important than knock-you-on-your-ass approach. Someone else says, hell no. Without considering all aspects, you get an overall horrible building. What good would a history teacher be if they could only teach about one specific year? Seems pretty stupid to me. Someone else says, it is abominable and embarrassing that the key functions of some of these buildings were compromised for the sake of formal or physical sandbox experiments. If the building does not do what it was meant to do, you've undermined the purpose of the building. I believe it's possible to create a building that does achieve and enhance its purpose, is beautiful, and is physically well considered. Emphasizing one aspect of the total at the expense of others is no way to solve a problem in a meaningful way. In architecture and in countless other problem-solving disciplines. Someone else says, I think a compromise needs to be struck between the three major considerations, and that is especially important to consider in the program and who it's being built for. Issues with the John Hancock Building aren't to me as egregious as issues with Aiub Hospital. Kahn put form ahead of saving lives, and that's just shitty. Someone else says, Ignoring important aspects of the building is the ultimate in architectural arrogance. The job of the architect is to strike a balance between competing needs, and ignoring some to focus entirely on a few others is abandoning that duty. Someone else says, obviously, just focusing on one area to perfection and completely ignoring other factors is ignorant bullshit. Woo, pardon my French. With all the human effort that goes into a building and the longevity of the building's functional requirements to the users, it's a cop-out maneuver to ignore any aspects of a building's design. And then finally on this, yes, there should be some balance point of view. This one is great. Be prepared. This one is really cool. Why is Michael Jordan the greatest of all time? Kareem scored more points. Bill Russell won more rings. Dwight Howard has more Defensive Player of the Year awards. And Shaq has more All-Star games. Jordan doesn't lead in any major career category. He is the best because he had it all. Buildings, like Mike, have to have it all to be the best. Jesus. I love that. Okay, then there were other people who, didn't feel the same way, that felt like the power and the potency that singularity brings is more appropriate. Someone says, yes, focusing on one main thing is important. I won't compromise. Perfection is important. Someone else says, well, the saying goes, if you try to please everyone, you end up pleasing no one. There is no such thing as a building without flaws, so an architect may well perfect a single aspect that people could praise rather than having a mediocre building with only minor problems. Someone else says, yes, power is the most important thing. We're all striving for power socially and politically, so it makes sense that we mimic that in our buildings. Someone else says, anyone who says that power in a building isn't important clearly hasn't been emotionally connected to architecture. At least in my case, I can say that powerful buildings strike my mind and leave a mark on me. And I know that it does to the world as well. Otherwise, how would iconic buildings around the world grow to be so recognized? And finally, someone says, I believe that society's buildings need to be potent buildings. Just as Mises believed that a society depends on its institutions for progress, I think that potent buildings give society a sense of power and progression. So, as with all of these things, there's room for a variety of perspectives on this. But today we're gonna take another approach. We're gonna look at it a slightly different way. And it maybe is, as I mentioned last time, this notion of singularity, of focus, of concentration in order to get power and potency. This is a kind of late 20th century notion. And it's in other fields. It's not just in architecture. That notion of finding this pure, clear truth that you're going to pursue. And maybe ignoring a little bit of static or other things and making them irrelevant in order to find this pure, clear idea in politics or in science or in art or in other fields as well. Now, these days, we often refer to the difference between those two mindsets, one that says that, yes, we seek perfection, and another one that says, no, maybe it's more complicated than that. Maybe you need to have more divergence, more variety. We sometimes call one way of thinking a modern way of thinking, and the other one a postmodern way of thinking. A modern way of thinking would have said that there is truth. We're seeking truth. We're seeking fact. And there is a clear answer. That was Einstein believing as a good modernist that there is an overarching theory of the universe. It's, these guys thinking that there's an answer out there. And then a more postmodern point of view is that maybe there isn't that kind of ultimate truth. Maybe there's just our belief at any point in time. And that, you know, if you look at the history of science, Galileo thought he had the whole answer, and then, you know, along came Newton and kicked him on his ass. No, he found out new things. And yeah, we might think we know everything exactly right now, but it's probably likely that in the future, some of what we think of as fact is not going to be fact anymore. So it's belief more than it is truth or fact. Modern way of thinking says there is fact, there is truth. Postmodern way of thinking is a little more skeptical and acknowledges that maybe this is just belief that we have right now. A modern way of thinking would emphasize idealization. We're seeking the ideal. And a postmodern way of thinking might be more about relativism. Well, we're seeking the best in this particular instance. But is it best for all times in all cases? No, it's relative. All of those things are relative. A modern way of thinking would really seek very strongly a clear order, that there is an answer, there is an order that we're working toward. A postmodern way of thinking is much more about reality. What are the circumstances? What is this instance? Maybe it's a little more messy than some kind of perfect clarity and order. A modern way of thinking would acknowledge there's a utopia. There is perfection out there. And a more postmodern way of thinking might emphasize more everyday life. No, there's not any utopia. We're all in this doing the best we can, and the best you can do is the best you can do, and it's, you know, that's what we need to be seeking. A modern way of thinking would be very, very, would think that there is a rational way to approach things. A postmodern way of thinking acknowledges that maybe it's more about emotion and that there isn't a logic or rationale for everything. So in film and in literature and in many, many disciplines, we think of a postmodern version of that discipline and we think of a modern version of that discipline, and they approach the discipline in a slightly different way. And one of the things that would be true in a postmodern approach is that one seeks synergy. And synergy is a not a very modern notion. Synergy is like 1 + 1 = 3. That if you put two things together, they may be better in combination than any of them were singularly. And that's a kind of counter-rational notion, that 1 + 1 = 3. But that is a postmodern idea, that you actually get extra benefit by breadth, by things that are not just singular, but that they're multiple at the same time. You get a kind of generative effect from that. And so, in a way, you could look at the devices around us. There were modern devices, like the telephone and your watch and your calendar and the TV and the stereo, and each one of those singular things was optimized for a particular performance so that you got a watch that was just a damn good watch and told you the time really, really efficiently and easily and in a place where you could see it and, you know, the sort of seeing the dial go around and all of that kind of thing. And so that a watch was designed just to do one thing. And then likewise, your telephone was designed to do quite a different thing and optimized for that. And your stereo was designed to just listen to music and absolutely be optimized for that. And that's a modern approach to things. But now, in a postmodern world, we have a gadget that does all of those things. So is it the very best telephone? Probably not. I mean, it's a little harder to hear. It's maybe not quite as good as a telephone as the old telephone, but hell, it's a telephone and it's doing all these other things. And it's the library, and it's your watch, and it's your telephone, and it's your music source, and it's your entertainment source, and it's doing many things. Is it as good listening to music on this as on a stereo with high-velocity Bose speakers? No, but, you know, put the earbuds in. Sounds pretty good. You can listen to music. So in a postmodern world, we have tended to compromise some of those things because there is somehow a synergy in being able to put them all together. And it actually, I think, affects the way we think and the way we approach problems in a larger sense. So there's a fantastic book called Everything Bad is Good for You. It's a stupid title, but it's actually quite a good book. But it looks at how postmodern media primarily has actually affected the way we think and the way we approach things. And that now we really are postmodern beings. We're not modern beings much anymore. So one example they use in that book is a modern TV show would have been a show like there was a cops and robbers show called Dragnet in the 1950s and 1960s, classic modern era. And in that, if you looked back at that TV show right now, it is so different from any, we got plenty of cops and robbers TV shows now, but it's completely different. So in that TV show, there were like five characters, same five characters every single episode. You got to know them extremely well. And, you know, just a few characters, very clear, very orderly, very singular. There was only one plot in every episode. It started at the beginning, it told you the story, it had a tidy end at the end of it. Every single episode was completely self-contained and very complete. There was not any carryover from one episode to the next. You didn't have to know what happened in the previous episodes to appreciate exactly what happened in that episode. Everything was a standalone piece. And that's a modern TV mechanism. Maybe about the 1990s, that kind of TV show just went away. And now virtually every TV show, and you could take something like Breaking Bad, you know, it's got like 40 characters in it. And there are 16 different subplots, even within one episode. And if you didn't watch that episode five times ago where they gave you one little clue, you're not going to be able to understand this episode three hints. And it's very complicated. Lots of plots that are weaving with each other, overlapping each other, lots of characters that are coming in and coming out. And that's a postmodern way of approaching film or TV or something like that. And the truth is now, if I sat all of you in front of a TV and made you watch an hour of Dragnet, you'd be bored senseless. You would hate it. It's too slow. It's too pat. It's not complicated enough. Your brain is ready to absorb more issues, more facts, more data. Even if you're cooking dinner and you're not even paying any attention, you still are absorbing all that. You know, okay, she's divorcing him because of blah, 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 blah. And then three episodes later, that's going to be really important to know. But we're accustomed to that multitasking, multivalent, lots of input, and sorting it all out. And our brain just works that way now. And it comes from film and video games and TV, and now we're bored if something doesn't have that level of complexity. Now, I don't know, can you relate to that? Do you feel like this is true of your brain? Are we really more multivalent? Are we really less singular? Do we really think on multiple tracks at the same time? Are we really more about synergy than about that one singular yes that's done perfectly? There's a notion that in a postmodern world, that's what success is. That's what accomplishment is that multivalence. So there's a big implication of that on architecture and actually on any kind of problem solving, and in particular any kind of creative problem solving, because it opens a window to how we deal with this myriad of issues, that now we seek synergy. We're trying to do that and that at the same time, and by doing both of those, maybe not perfectly but pretty completely, we get three. One and one equals three. Instead of we did that perfectly, but that's one and one equals two. And they're not they don't reach synergy yet. So we're going to look at a few buildings today, and we're going to be trying to figure out how would this apply to architecture, and how might you design a building in a way that dealt with all of these things rather completely, and often deal with multiple things at once. And one gesture ends up dealing with form, and at the same time, it's dealing with physical considerations. One particular design move is making you successful in terms of human use, and at the very same time, creating a very beautiful and sophisticated form. Is it possible by linking these things together and viewing them concurrently that we actually get a more sophisticated product? So we're going to look at a few good buildings here that I think measure up almost any criteria you put on these buildings. They measure up pretty damn well. There are no kind of egregious problems, as we saw in the buildings last time. And I would vote for maybe saying these also achieve a certain kind of power in a different way. Not a one-liner power, not like whack, knock you on your ass, one big move, but a power by synergy and a power by this kind of multiplicity and multivalence. So the first building we're looking at here is the de Young Museum in San Francisco. The architects are Herzog and Demeron. It was done in 2005. There had been an original de Young Museum on this site. There had been an earthquake in San Francisco in, I think, 2002 or something like that, and that had undermined the structural stability of the old museum building. And so they had to tear it down and build a new building because it was not salvageable anymore. And they built it on exactly the same site, but a completely different kind of building. So there was this garden, which we see in the slide on the right, this very formal garden that was between the de Young Museum and another museum opposite it. And so the de Young very much holds the face of that garden and addresses the garden like the old building did. But the other side of the de Young Museum is Golden Gate Park, and it's this beautiful, wild, lovely, huge park in San Francisco. It goes all the way out to the Pacific Ocean. And whereas the old building didn't really acknowledge the natural side of the building, it just addressed the more formal urban side, the new building sought to do both. So the old building, in a more traditional way, said, I'm one thing. I'm an urban building facing this garden. The new building says, I'm an urban building facing this garden, but I'm also a rural building sitting in a park. And so already, just in the most basic moves, the building is saying there are different things going on at the same time. So in a certain way, it's a very formal, kind of flat building on one side addressing the formal garden. And on the other side, it gets loose and organic and addresses more the garden. So we're going to look at this building, and we're going to look at about three or four big moves in the building. And I'm going to make the argument that these moves are powerful because they're doing three things at once. They're not just doing one thing. They're doing multiple things, and they're getting a certain power out of that. So one of the moves I want us to look at is this tower on the right-hand side of the building in the left slide, that tower right there. So basically, the galleries of the museum are down here facing this garden. And then there's a tower that has an observation deck up at the top up there. And then it has all the administrative offices for the people who run the museum in the tower itself. And so in a certain way, you can understand the tower just as a functional thing. And what the architects decided very early on was, all right, we have this beautiful site in the middle of a park, but one thing nobody's ever experienced on this site is if you get up a little higher, because it's at the top of a hill and because it's in the Bay Area, if you get up high enough, you get this amazing 360-degree view. A view that goes all the way to the skyline of San Francisco, goes to the Golden Gate Bridge, goes to the Pacific Ocean, spectacular view. No one ever saw it in the old building because the old building was in the woods and hovered down there low. But they thought if you could get up, you could get this spectacular view. So purely as a functional thing, this is a way to try to get more people to visit the museum because honestly, it's a little bit remote. This had never been a very popular museum. And they were trying to get more people to patronize the museum. So Herzog and Dimeron suggested, what if we made one of the galleries, one of the exhibit spaces, have this breathtaking view? And everybody would want to come there because they'd love to participate in this gorgeous view. And so it's just a functional thing. How do we get more people in our museum? How do we affect people's behavior? Well, we give them this bit of just incredible, delicious candy, this incredible view, and we entice people to come to the building because of that. So one real reason for the tower is to get up that high so you can get this spectacular view, so you can get more gate, so your museum is more successful. Also, there are these functions of the administrators. Honestly, usually they're buried like, you know, in the back of house or in the basement or some kind of unpleasant place in the museum. They generally don't interact a lot with the actual functions of the museum. These are the people who are, you know, planning a show 5 years from now or something, or they're, dealing with fundraising and membership goals. And so they need to be near the museum, but they don't need to be in the middle of the museum. So putting them in this tower gives them quite a nice view and a kind of separateness and the ability not to feel like they're an alien in the middle of something that is about a completely different enterprise, which is looking, all these patrons are looking at art. So from a functional point of view, it makes a lot of sense to have this tower and have this view and have this separation of the administrative functions. So you could say we're optimizing human factors. We're optimizing use here. But at the very same time as they're doing that, they're also thinking about issues of form. How could we make this sculptural? How could we make this a really beautiful, memorable object? And they take a rectangular plan and they sort of twist it each floor at a little bit different angle, and they make this really sexy shape. And then they sheathe it in materials that are, it's this very kind of matte, shiny copper. And so there's this sumptuous, reflective quality to it. And that you see it from different angles in different places in the park, and it looks completely different. It's also kind of diaphanous. You can a little bit see through the corners of the building. It's kind of semi-transparent. So they arrange the form, and they sheathe it in materials that make it really quite a wonderful piece of sculpture. So in terms of issues of form, that tower is all about being a prominent, really cool form. So it's dealing with issues of form in a very sophisticated way. Now the other thing, and this one just kind of blows you away, but the other thing they're doing here is it's an earthquake-prone area. Obviously that's what screwed up the old building. And in an earthquake-prone area, what you're worried about is lateral loads, shear loads that we talked about when we were talking about physical considerations. And if you make diagonals in a building as opposed to parallel and perpendicular, it takes those shear loads and distributes them in a very effective way. So by twisting this building as it went up instead of just making a stacked rectangle, they actually accomplished a structural stability and a resistance to earthquakes and the ability to match the codes, the very stringent earthquake codes that are now in place in San Francisco, so that it reacted to physical considerations. Now, at the very same time, that one gesture is about human factors, that gesture is about form, and that gesture is about physical considerations. That gesture is about getting you up and getting you that cool-ass view as a human being. It's about making a very sexy, exotic shape, and it's about resisting earthquake forces. Now, that is synergy. that's at the very same time thinking of all of these things and letting them generate together something that I think in the end is extremely powerful. So that's one aspect of the building's design. Now, I want you to kind of just get yourself in the head of these architects, which is a very different mental state than being in the head of Lou Kahn or being in the head of, James Stirling when they were doing some of the buildings we looked at last time. Instead of trying to do one thing and think about it and concentrate on it and do it perfectly, instead they're always thinking in layers. How can we do multiple things, and how does that generate a different kind of solution? So let's take another issue, which is maybe the skin of the building. So I told you that they wrapped this tower in this copper skin. And in fact, they're really thinking of the entire building here. How do we make a surface for the building that will do lots of things that that surface needs to do? Okay, one thing for sure is that it's going to be about form. So we're going to want something that's handsome, that's a nice color, that's a nice texture. So they've got this very interesting perforated metal skin that has got a very interesting color and texture. It was meant to have a color that's very sympathetic to the landscape colors. So it's kind of brownish at the beginning, but as copper oxidizes, it gets kind of greenish. So being in this natural environment where things are brown and green and earth colors, in terms of form, it's very sympathetic to that surrounding. And in terms of buildings and the land and physical considerations, trying to make something that is an extension of the ecosystem or the environment around it, that color and texture, that lightness, like those wispy trees, eucalypt trees that you see there, and the sort of lightness of that skin that somehow has characteristics of the physical environment around. Certainly in terms of physical considerations, it's extremely durable material. Copper lasts forever, requires no maintenance, just takes care of itself. That's certainly something about physical considerations. But then they also have to think, well, exactly how do we use this copper? And they actually, they perforate it because sometimes they need to be able to see through for view, or sometimes they need it to be sunshading where it's letting some of the light through but not letting other light through. Sometimes they need it to be a ventilator, so they've got air conditioning systems that have to get air in and out. And sometimes it needs to be solid and opaque. So it needs to be all of those different things. So sometimes it's perforated very, very significantly and sometimes not so much. It also, as you can see on the slide on the left, this interesting texture where it's actually not only perforated, but it's also embossed. So that just like when you corrugate metal, it makes it stronger. When you give it some depth, it strengthens the material. It doesn't bend or warp so easily. So they put these indentations to give it greater strength. So you've got the combination of the perforation and the embossing that can give you stronger material or not so strong material, more porous material or less porous material. So they've got this very flexible material that then they can wrap pretty much the entire building in. And in different parts, it can play different roles. This actually is a big ventilation panel for the air conditioning system. So it goes from being fairly solid over here to being quite open where you need to, instead of having dumb, ugly louvers here, we've just perforated the metal in a certain way so we can get the air in and out. And this happens all over the building. It goes from different levels of perforation and different levels of embossing, and when they need greater strength or when they need greater openness, and it reacts to all that. But that material and the way that material is used is doing multiple things. In the slide on the right, I don't know if you can exactly see it there, but the actual signage of the building, the spelling out DeYoung, there's the Y-O-U-N-G, and the spelling out of the name actually is being executed by not having any embossing or not having any perforation in parts of it and having embossing and perforation in other parts of it. And it lets them communicate this meaning, you know, human factors in the building. Other things that's generating that skin are technical factors like sunshading these windows right here. Other kinds of things that are happening in the building is sometimes it's for sheltering a patio here that's outside the cafe and letting you get dappled light through it so that it is both shading, physical considerations, and human factors creating a kind of sheltered place for use. That decision about that skin was not made in a univalent way. That decision about that skin was made in a synergistic way. How can it do this and this and this and this and this and do all those things at the same time? A completely different way of thinking about how you make design decisions. And in the end, it kind of unifies the entire building, combines things that might be a mechanical room over here and might be a gallery over there and might be the entrance over here and allows the skin to have the flexibility to respond to all those different needs. So, okay, we have that tower designed in this synergistic way. We have the skin of the building so that it becomes a kind of piece of the landscape, becomes very complementary to the landscape. There also are just decisions all through the building. This interlocking with the landscape starts going into these little courtyards that are sliced into the building. And they're doing three or four things at once. They're letting daylight into the building. They're giving visual relief so that you don't get museum fatigue. Sometimes you go into a museum and you just, room after room after room, art after art after art, you just need a little visual relief. Well, those things, you turn a corner and you get a little visual relief all the way through there. So they're there for human factors, they're there for physical considerations of daylighting. Always it's multiple things that are shaping every design decision. So let's walk into the museum a little. There's a kind of sally port here. You go from the park out here in through that sally port into a little courtyard and finally into the lobby space of the building right there. And just as on the outside, on the inside, everything's about synergy, about multiplicity. So this stair on the left in the big lobby space. There's a huge piece of art on the wall across from it. And instead of just having a normal stair, it's a super wide stair, and it's kind of an amphitheater as well as a stair so that people often will sit on those steps. I was there one time where there was a dance performance happening right here, and people were sitting all over this as if it were an amphitheater looking at the dance performance. So it's functioning both as a normal stair to get from the first floor to the second floor, and it's double functioning to be a performance space in there. And it's triple functioning in terms of an element of form as this kind of sculptural object, this major event in that room taking you up to the second floor. There's another stair in another part of the building that's also doing about three or four things at once. Yes, it's a stair and it's taking you up from the first floor to the second floor. It also has one of those little sliver courtyards on the side so that you're getting views out into the garden out there and a little natural relief, periodic natural relief. It also is letting daylight into the building so that you don't have to have so much artificial light. And it also is a very sculptural object. It's something that's about form. When you get to that top gallery and you can see those grand views out to the Pacific Ocean and the hills of San Francisco all the way around there. Again, it's doing multiple things. I'm able to see exhibits up there, but I'm also able to see the view. It isn't like singularly telling you one experience. It's about multiple experiences at once. It's much more like Breaking Bad than it is like Dragnet. It's much more about acknowledging that people can do multiple things at once. You needn't be just focused on one thing. And then inside the museum, God, they just did a wonderful job with the museum's collections. This is a museum with extremely eclectic collection. So it's maybe got three primary strengths. One of them is they have like the world's best exhibit of South Pacific Ocean artifacts by ancient tribal people. Very kind of esoteric bit of art. But in order to do that, they need these very, these environments that really make you focus on these tiny precious objects. So these are little bitty stone carvings and little bitty wood carvings that are hundreds of years old, done by these tribal people in Borneo and places like that. So the galleries here are very dark. The light kind of shines very specifically on these precious little objects, and it makes you really focus your attention on them. So that's one kind of gallery that's in the space. But then you go from that, and the next room might be a place where they're showing contemporary art. They have quite a significant contemporary art collection. And it would be stupid to put the contemporary art in those kinds of spaces. These are big, open, light-filled spaces with nice views to the outside and lots of daylight. Completely different feeling, because it's a completely different kind of art. And then they also have a real strength in early American art, not just painting, but also silver, production of silver, and furniture. And so they have galleries that are exhibiting that. And whereas most art museums, you have kind of one kind of architecture that's doing everything, and maybe have their contemporary collection here, and they have their Baroque art here, and they're all in the same framework. Here, this is this multiplicity idea. We don't have to have everything consistent. We can have one particular kind of thing about this kind of art, and a very different one about this, and a very different one about this. And as a synergy, they come together in a more powerful and positive way than that consistency, that uniformity, that order would have meant. This is a different way of thinking of how you put all those issues together. Now, some of you may know that our own Blanton Museum, back in the late 1990s, when they were planning the Blanton Museum, they originally selected Herzog and Demeron, this architect, to be the architect for the Blanton Museum. And then that museum ran into some issues. There were a couple of the regents who did not like the idea of having this architect from Switzerland come over to do the building. And there were some politics and other things that came into it. Eventually, Herzog and Demeron were released from the job. And they hired another architect, and that got us the Blanton we have here. Actually, just at the moment that they lost the commission here at UT, they got the commission for the de Young Museum. And it's really significant to me, the difference in what kind of museum we would have had on the UT campus if these architects with this approach to architecture had done that building, as opposed to the architects that eventually were hired, which were very modernist in a sense, and that it's a very consistent, very ordered, very clear, very singular building. And instead, we would have gotten a building that was, I think, more challenging, more multivalent, more accommodating, and the eclectic collection of the Blanton, which now is housed in all the galleries, look pretty much the same, whether they're going to have Baroque art in them or whether they're going to have contemporary art in them. Instead, we would have had the kind of variety and multiplicity that we're seeing here. So that's another way of thinking about how you approach this myriad of issues that are in any design problem. Okay, let's look at another example. This one is the thermal baths at Valls. The architect is Peter Zumthor. Peter Zumthor, a very, very prominent architect, still very much in practice, as Herzog and Demeron are. These are two of probably the most preeminent architects in the world right now, are Peter Zumthor and Herzog and Demeron. This was a very interesting case where Peter Zumthor is Swiss. Most of his work is in Switzerland. He was given this challenge by the little town of Valls. Valls was a ski resort, But it was a tiny little town. It wasn't a magnificent mountain where the ski resort was, but it was a nice little ski resort. And then in the 1990s, it turned out that ski resorts in Switzerland, you had to have 40 different runs, and you have to have 6 lifts to even start to compete. The little ski villages just were getting beat out by the big guys. And the little town of Valls lost its economic wherewithal. This was about the only thing they depended on was big ski season every year. And when all the skiers went to the bigger mountains, they lost their economic basis. So the city fathers got together and they said, well, you know, there is one other thing that we have going for us. One thing that was great in ski season was they would have, after you finish your skiing, you'd go and have a thermal bath. You'd have a warm bath. And they had these hot springs there that were fueling the thermal baths. So they said, well, could we make something out of that? If we can't get the skiers, can we at least get people who come here for a spa for thermal baths? So they hired Peter Zumthor because they realized that just having thermal baths wasn't enough. You're going to have some kind of extraordinary experience of the baths in order to have people make an effort to go to Valls and stay there. So Zumthor is given the challenge of how do you take this simple thing of having hot water that comes naturally out of the earth and you experiencing that in your body, your skin, you know, those sensual qualities of it. How can we heighten that to a point that it will make people want to make this a destination? So one of the things he begins with, and he's always, like Herzog and Dimmeron, he's thinking in multiple layers. He's a very ecological kind of guy. He's very sensitive to the landscape and to the topography and to the sites that he's given. Often he has beautiful sites in Switzerland and beautiful landscape, and he wants to be respectful of that. And at the same time, he's also trying to make this very dynamic form, you know, something where it's going to be just incredible, luscious place that people are going to want to come back and tell their friends about and be excited about. So it can't be so nondescript. It's got to have some presence as well. And at the same time, also, it really is about physical considerations. This is about heat and cold, and so how do I manage that well? And so the building is really coming out of all of those issues. He begins by, in many ways, burying the building. He starts the building in the ground, and just as the water, the thermal baths, there's springs that come out of the ground. So he starts you in a cave down here in the middle of the ground, and then he slowly takes you up and out to the point that you can see then beautiful views of the Alps, and you emerge from the ground and out to the larger landscape. So there you can see how subtle and how delicate the building sits in the ground. It actually is the hillside is tumbling down here, and the hillside turns into these sod roofs that continue the grass from the hillside onto the ground. And here we're standing above the building. You can barely tell there's a building there at all because it's just kind of hollowed out of the slope of the hill as it's going down there. So very respectful of the natural terrain that's there, very merging into the environment. But then at a certain point, just as maybe there's a rock outcropping on that mountain or a cliff, the building then kind of becomes a piece of the mountain and has the scale of a mountain, not a fussy little gingerbread scale, a rather bold scale like can hold its own against the scale of the mountain. And that's the point at which people then can see the big views and get natural light and be connected out to that larger alpine landscape. He makes the entire building out of a stone that's just sitting there in the geology of this area. It's a beautiful green stone. And all the little huts in the neighborhood around there are made out of horizontal layers of this green stone that they use in slates. He uses it in a much more refined way, but he also keeps it in those horizontal layers because it's sedimentary rock, and he makes the entire building out of exactly what's below the ground there, the geological piece of the earth. Everything very driven by function. I mean, he's orchestrating this, what has to be dealt with sensitively in terms of public and private areas. You're asking people to go in here, and they're going to take off all their clothes, and they're going to get into very little clothing, and then they're going to move into a public space where they're going to interact with total strangers with very little clothes on. So how do you orchestrate that public-private transition? So you actually enter the building underground through a tunnel, and you go back up here to, boy, I love that dancing thing. That's kind of cool. And you have all these changing rooms here where you go in, and they're individual changing rooms. So you go in and you have your little key, and you open up, and it's like a little changing space. You take off your clothes, you put on your bathing suit, you walk out from that into this larger area, and you begin to then be, that's the little individual rooms for changing. And you then come into this area where you're beginning to be more in a public space. And you're still in a cave. It still feels like the earth. In terms of physical considerations, you've got that high thermal mass. He's able to keep the density of the soil and the earth. That's what's keeping that water hot. He's using it then an extension in these big stone walls to have the thermal density to keep the baths warm without having to heat them a whole lot, especially in freezing cold alpine winter. So in terms of physical considerations, very strong. The local stone, the structural material is very appropriate. The thermal mass of it's very appropriate. In terms of form, it just feels so much like the land. All that sedimentary soil, the sedimentary rock, the horizontal layering of it, very much like what you see in the landscape outside. And also just sumptuously beautiful. Basically dark with just little bits of light that come in. And very soft, very modulated light. And now you're beginning in a social way to gather maybe with your other family members or friends that you came with and making decisions. And there are all kinds of different baths. You can go in a tepid bath. You can go in a warm bath. You can go in a blazing hot bath. You can go in a freezing cold bath. And the sort of movement from one bath to the other and feeling the water on your skin and feeling the change of temperature and some places that are steamy and hot like a sauna and other places that are refreshing and cool, and you're moving from one of these to the other and always in this beautiful kind of mysterious light that's in it. So it's form, absolutely. It's just as sensuous as hell. It's physical considerations. It's about thermal stability. It's about the actual rock in the ground. It's human factors. It's about privacy and public and being with your friends and having the social time and the pleasure of that. It's all of those things working absolutely concurrently. And the net result is this place that just became immediately phenomenally popular. So people will go for miles and miles and miles and spend nights in those hotels that were going bankrupt because the skiers weren't there anymore. And now they stay at those hotels and they come to the thermal baths and they enjoy the baths and it gives the economic vitality back to the town. Now, is it the knock you on your ass one-liner kind of design? No. It's rich and multivalent and layered decision on top of decision. But in the end, has an enormous power and potency and has made a big economic success out of a town that was falling apart. And then at the end, you kind of can experience those baths and then come out to this deck and see the beautiful alpine view there and lie in the sun. If it's a summertime day like when I was there, and it's an amazing experience. Now, the bottom line of all this is, what is the right way to manage making all these decisions and design? Was Paul Rudolph right? I mean, there were some people who said last time, yes, that's absolutely correct. But maybe there's another way of thinking, and maybe a way of thinking that in some ways your generation is better at than prior generations because you've attuned your mind to see things in multiple ways rather than singular ways. Okay, last class today. We got one Twitter card question left here. The Twitter card question today is kind of two parts. One thing I would request that you fill out the course evaluation that you should have gotten an email on. So I'm saying part of the Twitter card question today is for you to go home and search out that email if you've put it aside, or pay attention. I think they'll give you another alert today, or it has to be done by midnight tomorrow. I would really appreciate you filling out the course evaluation. I pay a lot of attention to those. I'm always trying to make the class better, and I depend on that feedback. But for the Twitter card question right here, right now, I would like for you to do one of the following. Either say, this is something that was good about this course that you should continue to do, or this is something I didn't think was so good about this course that you ought to change. Two choices. You can say, this is something good about this course that you should absolutely continue to do, or this is something that was not so good about this course that I think you should change.